Back on 98.7 ESPN, Carlin with you until 10 o'clock as usual. Joining us now, former president of the Miami Marlins. He's got a podcast. He's working for CBS All Access. He's doing everything right now. He is David Sampson. David, appreciate it, man. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it very much. You know, first of all, let's talk about this from a business standpoint. Going through the winter meetings and not having winter meetings, this has just been a bizarre week, an absolutely bizarre week. How have you from the outside, knowing what it normally looks like on the inside, taken a look at this?
Well, to me, it's perfect 2020, right? Because normally right now there'd be wall-to-wall coverage for baseball, and I'm sure that the commissioner is despondent right now because there's not a lot of baseball being spoken about, not a lot of free agents are being signed. The NBA is coming back already. NFL's going on. So I think there's a little bit of upsetness on behalf of baseball saying, where's the news? The problem is they don't exactly know when the season's going to start. They have some labor issues they have to deal with. And on top of that, owners are saying, listen, I don't even know whether there's going to be fans when we start playing again. So how am I supposed to set my payroll? And I think all of those things have combined to make the winter meetings, which are virtual now anyway, to make them really not a big news story, unfortunately.
Okay, but is as much going to get done? First of all, what really gets done when you've been in person at the winter meetings? Is there a more of a likelihood for more to get done in person or not?
No, actually, from a team standpoint, I'll tell you that if I could get rid of the winter meetings and make them virtual every year, I would love it because it was a big expense item for us. We would send so many employees. It would take 5 days of our lives and between air and hotel and food and yada, yada, yada. The fact of the matter is when winter meetings started, they were minor league meetings. They were for minor leagues. And when the major league teams were involved, that's back before cell phones, back before 7 day a week, 24 hour day communication between the clubs. And it was an opportunity to actually see other GMs and other presidents face to face. Now with FaceTime, now with texting, we actually did some trades without even a phone call, just texting. So the days of going from suite to suite and walking around and seeing people in the lobby, those days are pretty much over. And I think that having them virtual this year, that's not the reason why things aren't being done. It's the other reasons we talked about.
What trades did you get done by text? I'm just curious. Do you remember any particular ones?
Oh, I can't, not a particular one, but I'll tell you that anyone that doesn't involve a lot of money switching hands where you don't need permission of the commissioner has to approve any amount of money over $1 million going back or forth in a trade. So any non-money trade, like a minor league trade, minor league player for player, or sort of a, when there's a waiver claim, you know, after you waive a player or designate a player, you have 10 days to either trade or release him or just he'll be outrighted. Those trades of marginal players can be done via text. So it is not epic to have that happen. Even free agency now is done sometimes without seeing the player. Remember in New York, there was with Carl Pavano, who pitched for us in the 03 World Series. They called it Carlapalooza. Do you remember that?
Yes, absolutely I do.
That's when he was going around and visiting all these places and that you'd prepare videos for the players. You'd get celebrities to go on your Jumbotron and record a video.
How did they do all that for Carl Pavano, for Pete's sake? It happened for Carl Pavano.
Carl Pavano ended up firing his agent over that Yankees deal. Did you know that?
I did not know that. How could you fire your agent when you got, I think it was what, 4 years for $40 million? Wasn't it something like that?
So he thought he was getting like $1 million more than he ended up getting. And he ended up getting rid of his agent because of that. Carl's a great guy. I've absolutely enjoyed spending time with him. I had him with the Expos, had him with the Marlins, won a World Series with him. But I just think back to those days and a fit. He was never going to be a fit in New York. He's a sensitive guy. You know, he's very big and burly, but he was always sensitive and nice and kind. You know how New York just can eat up some pitchers? You've seen it throughout the years. Guys who come to New York and just can't pitch. We saw it recently with Sonny Gray, I think.
Yeah, who and came somehow to New York. His name started coming up again the last week or so, and you can't figure out why.
So there's just some people who just don't want to be in that sort of fishbowl that is New York, especially coming from Montreal or Florida, where there's five members of the media and they're all nice to you.
David Sampson, the former president of the Miami Marlins, now hosts the Nothing Personal podcast on CBS Sports Podcasts, available wherever you get your podcasts. All right. Speaking of money, Steve Cohen, the Mets' new owner. Give me the outsider's perspective on Steve Cohen as somebody that has understood what it looks like from the inside.
So what I've been talking about on Nothing Personal, which is my show that I do every day for 45 minutes, where I get to talk about all sorts of cool stuff that people want to hear and I want to talk about. Steve Cohen, the real question as a Mets fan that you should be asking, how serious a case of new owner-itis does Steve Cohen have? That's what we're going to find out here over the next 30 days. If he signs Bauer and Springer and James McCann, then you can say that he's got new owner-itis to the nth degree, because he wants to come in, make a bunch of sexy, splashy signings. It's all very exciting when you win the offseason. I was part of a team that won the offseason in 2012 when we signed the former Met Jose Reyes and Heath Bell and Mark Burley. And guess what? We only won the offseason. We didn't do anything during the regular season. And that's sort of the danger of winning the offseason. It is very rare that a team that does that ends up getting a ring at the end of the day. But the good news is, according to Steve Cohen, you have 3 to 5 years before you can be upset with him for not winning a World Series.
Yeah, when he said that, there were the stories out there that somehow that was a little bit off-putting to potential candidates to either be president of operations, which they've now backed off of, down to general manager. I'm curious as to why candidates would look at it that way when you have the chance to work for Sandy Alderson, who, you know, at the very least is going to be very level-headed in all of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's at all what happened. Candidates are not put off by an owner who wants to spend money. They actually want that because they want to be able to cover their mistakes. Yeah. When you work for a team that has a low payroll, any mistake you make becomes magnified. So when you have a chance to have money, let's say the way the Dodgers do, where if you make a bad signing, it doesn't matter. You make a bad trade, it doesn't matter. You just release the player, get rid of the player, don't play the player, doesn't really matter. So I think every candidate would want it. Why they haven't hired as of yet? I think that's because Sandy Alderson wants a little more power in terms of running the baseball operations. And if you bring in a president of baseball ops and you bring in a general manager, that's adding two levels of people you have to deal with. And I think Sandy, at the end of the day, while he's being brought in to run the business and baseball, you can't run both of those with nobody helping you. It's simply impossible. So if he wants to focus more on baseball, they're going to have to bring someone in to run the business.
David, when you look at the Mets in the pursuit of McCann versus Real Muto, you've been around Real Muto, you know about him, and you know what a tremendous guy he is, but give me the sense of how big of a drop-off you feel like that is, and are you a little bit surprised that Real Muto wasn't the guy that they targeted?
If I had to choose two of three of the big three, I would sign Real Muto and I would sign Springer. I would not sign Bauer. I don't think Bauer in a long-term deal is someone that's going to, him in the New York media, it's going to be a sideshow every single day. It's going to be a huge distraction in a clubhouse. It's going to be a lot for Luis Rojas to deal with to the extent that he stays manager for any period of time. The reality is, Real Muto is the best catcher in the game. The problem is he wants, let's say, 6 or 7 years, and he's 30 or 31 years old. It's not going to be a good deal 5 years from now. Why am I saying five? Because Steve said we have to win a World Series in the next 3 to 5. Therefore, I would take JT any day over McCann, who 2 years ago was basically a non-tender.
David Sampson with us, and he, of course, a former president of the Marlins. Okay, Yankees perspective here. This is something I've been talking about a lot. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds of the finances, but the Yankees payroll has been somewhere between, at the very low end, $170 million for 1 or 2 years to a little bit north of $200 million for about 15 years. Yet their revenues have tripled. And now Hal Steinbrenner's talking about constantly how much money they lost this past offseason. David, separate fact from fiction here about what to buy into what Hal's saying versus the notion that the Yankees are just not willing to basically cover up for their expensive mistakes anymore.
I think that you have to recognize a couple things that people don't talk much about. The Yankees as a baseball team have been losing money every single year since they got to the new Yankee Stadium. The debt they have on the new stadium is substantial. The revenue they received by moving into the new stadium did not increase the way they thought. All those high-priced seats, all of the areas they thought they would sell out, that just hasn't happened. But the Yankees have survived because of their broadcast deal. They've survived because of their ownership in Yes Network. But there was a transaction where they took a lot of money off the table, gave up quite a bit of ownership in Yes Network to partners, and took that cash to help absorb losses and pay down debt service. Now, last year, there was zero gate revenue. That is a huge amount of money, and their payroll has been frankly too large and is underperformed by too much that I think Cal is just tired of it.
Okay, but when you hear $683 million, what kind of annual debt service is that outside of your operating costs that you're losing that kind of money all those years before? 683 being the number in 2019.
I'm sorry. That's the first time hearing this. Are you saying that Hal said that he lost $683 million in 2019?
No. The Yankees' revenue in 2019 was $683 million. So I'm curious where that difference is there.
So you have to break down where their revenue is. Let's say that they get 50% of their revenue from tickets, parking, food, concessions, merchandise. So let's say that they would have about $250 million in revenue just from those things. If you're not getting that, that's $250 off the board. Next, their broadcast deal. If you're only showing 60 games instead of 160, you're getting under a third of what you would normally get in terms of all of your revenue. So their revenue would be substantially decreased. Now their expenses were decreased in that player payroll was only 60/162nd of what it normally would be. I believe Hal that they're losing money. I believe Hal he doesn't want to pay competitive balance tax. I also believe Hal that he wants to win, given the fact they have not won a World Series since 2009. They've spent a fortune. And if you think that Hal enjoyed watching Stu Sternberg and the Tampa Bay Rays in the World Series spending a fraction of the money he spends, it made him crazy.
I'm sure. Listen, there has never been any love lost between the Tampa organization and the Yankees, and we even saw that roll over onto the field. Okay, having said
that, it's jealousy, by the way, just so you know. It's straight up jealousy.
And it's jealousy on the part of the Yankees of the Rays? Why so?
Because what a great thing if you're Tampa that you're able to have a payroll of $80 million and compete with a team that has a payroll of $200 million. That means, think about what an owner says watching the World Series last year. They're looking at Tampa and they see all of these first or second year relievers being paid $500,000 and throwing 98, one after another. Meanwhile, you've got teams who are paying $10 million or more to a bullpen guy who's going to blow as many saves as the $500,000 guy. So you say to your GM, what are we doing? That's actually why Brad Hand was let go by the Indians, because the owner said, I'm not going to pay him $10 million. Let's get a guy who throws 98 and pay him $500,000.
All right. We're talking to David Sampson, former president of the Marlins and host of the Nothing Personal podcast. Does it every day, available wherever you get your podcasts. With that being said, if you're Hal, why does Brian Cashman seem to have a lifetime contract?
So I actually made a prediction on Nothing Personal. I don't think Brian Cashman will be the GM of the Yankees after this contract ends, unless he wins a World Series. I think it's finally going to be time that a change will have to be made, because it does seem he has a lifetime contract and he's done well. Although I could argue he did better in the beginning than he has recently, because they measure themselves on rings. That's it. Not on, and I was going to say NFC East. Can you imagine? Not on AL East titles, not on pennants. They measure it based on rings, and they've been ringless since 2009.
And it's painful to watch, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of accountability. It's painful to watch because you know what the possibilities are, and I'm sure it is for them when you see them do it for a lot less money. You see some of these teams do it for a lot less money outside of the Dodgers.
There's no question. That's why I think there'll be a change within the Yankees front office, and I think it makes sense. The owner can't fire himself. Randy Levine's not going anywhere, that's for sure. Therefore, it gets down to Brian Cashman, who, by the way, has had a Hall of Fame career, if you think about it, but recently it just hasn't worked out. It doesn't take a genius to sign Gerrit Cole. I would always say to our baseball people, listen, don't come to me and say you have your eyes on the top free agent in the market, how great he would be for our team, what a good fit he would be for our team. Find me a mid-tier free agent who's going to overperform, who will actually be paid less money than what he's worth, as opposed to all the other free agents who are paid more money than what they're worth. That's what a good front office does. And the Yankees just have not gotten that type of production. You could argue DJ LeMahieu may have outperformed his contract, but if the Yankees turn around and give him a four-year deal now at $20 million plus a year, they will regret that day, I promise you.
Okay, all right, hang on a second. This is where we're going to disagree, because when you look at every box that this guy checked for the last 2 years in terms of being a Yankee and all the intangibles and then the tangibles, all of the things that he does in terms of the versatility and such, that's one guy, David, that to me, I don't think gets measured properly analytically, and he's phenomenal analytically. He doesn't feel like somebody that in a couple of years is going to just fall off a cliff. So why is 4 years so ridiculous for DJ LeMahieu?
Because he's phenomenal. He was phenomenal at 12. If he had signed a two-year, $50 million deal when he came to the Yankees, would you be lauding him the way you are now?
Because he finished like in the top three or four for MVP each of the last 2 years.
But don't you think part of it is that, wow, what a great signing that was by the Yankees. Best free agent signing of two seasons ago. They got him at a bargain. Way to go, scouting. Way to go, player development, etc. When you sign a guy and he's got the expectation that he's all of a sudden one of the higher paid players on your team, that's just not proper allocation. They have to think about, are they going to sign Judge long term? What are they going to do with Torres? They've got to allocate money both to pitching and to hitting. They've got bullpen issues, believe it or not, with all they've done with Britton and Chapman.
Oh, they do. Yep.
They really do. And think about how much money they have in their bullpen. I just think that 4 years for LeMahieu, I think you're paying him for past performance instead of for future performance. And that's when you get into trouble with long-term free agent deals.
Man, I couldn't disagree more just based on the fact he's not 35, he's 32. And this has been somebody that has stepped in and done everything asked of him. And I would be lauding him if he had gotten that amount of money because of what he has accomplished here the last 2 years. I don't think that's going away. All right.
Let's do a show again in four. Let's see what he signs for.
Okay.
And let's make a promise that we'll do a show.
What do you think he's going to sign for?
We'll do a show once a year and we'll evaluate how that contract is going. I used to do this with our GM all the time, Larry Beinfest and Mike Hill. We would take a bunch of free agents and we would look at their contracts at the time of signing and then go back and look every single year. And the number of times that the contracts were good for the player and bad for the team far outstripped and outnumbered the number of times the contracts were better for the team than they were for the player.
What do you think he'll end up getting?
You know, in a normal offseason with normal desperation from older owners who are trying to win rings for the first time, I do think he gets a four-year deal, and I do think he gets $80 million for four. In this time of COVID, where there's quite a bit more belt tightening, and I think the middle class of free agents is going to get squozen in a way that they never have before, I think he may not find anything out there above $16 million a year for 3 years, and I think that that would be a reasonable signing for a team. Although I'm not sure I would do that unless my payroll was, call it 170 or above. So I would say the minimum is going to be 3 years at 16. I would have taken the qualifying offer if I had been him, take the 18.9, wow, go back to the Yankees, and then try to be a free agent again, still at not an old age, with the chance to have COVID behind you. And I think the maximum, if the Yankees are desperate and if they're paying attention to the media and letting the media make decisions, they may overpay and give him that four-year deal at 20 a year.
Okay. I'm remiss not to ask you about Mike Hill, because he's somebody that has interviewed for the position with the Mets, whether it was Sandy hiring a GM or the president of ops. Should the Mets hire Mike Hill from what you know of him?
Well, I worked with Mike Hill from 2003 to 2017 as assistant GM and president of baseball operations. He is a perfect hire. And if the Phillies get him instead of the Mets will regret that decision. And if the Mets get him instead of the Phillies will regret that decision. What's great about Mike Hill, he's dealt with every kind of owner. He dealt with Jeffrey Loria. He dealt with Derek Jeter. He's got experience with teams that do not have a lot of payroll flexibility. He has experience and understands how to smartly spend money. He is very good at gaining consensus amongst his people. He's very good at using analytics and eyes, ears, and stomach. He's very good at managing up, dealing with owners, very good at managing down and empowering the people who work with him, not for him. And he's also good at dealing with the media, which you have to have in New York. He checks every box for the opening, both in New York and in Philly.
Okay, last one, because we're a little bit short on time. Give me your best Derek Jeter story.
Oh, God, there's so many. Well, how much time do we have?
Give me my top five. We got as much time as you want. Go ahead.
I spent a lot of time with Derek when he was negotiating to buy the team. And the funny thing about Derek is he always thought that by telling me how much he liked me and how much he wanted me to stay with the team and work with him and be partners with him, I knew from the beginning he was full of it because I knew that he would fire me the minute he got the team. And I knew I was negotiating myself out of baseball because my job was to get the most money for the team, not to put myself in a position to stay on. So I never let Derek know that I realized this because I didn't mind when he would wine and dine me. So one time he had me to the Soho House, this private exclusive club, having drinks. I had a few drinks. And he said, hey, you want more drinks? I said, I'll have another one for sure. He said, keep drinking. The more you drink, I think you'll keep coming down with your price. I think a few more drinks will get you down $100 million. He's so used to everyone doing what he wants. He's so used to everyone genuflecting in his general direction. I was never impressed by him or his house or his chefs or his private clubs. I was only interested in him overpaying for the team. And I had him right where I wanted him because he thought that I cared about all that surfacey stuff that means nothing to me. And he ended up overpaying for the team and that's it. And he and I, of course, he's never spoken to me since the day when the deal closed. I walked out of Marlins Park. He walked into Marlins Park. Two ships passing in the night. He sat down at my old desk, and that was that.
All right, so there wasn't a phone call or a text message. That was the story at the time that he officially let you go that way. Like it was.
Oh, that. Yes, that is accurate. I found out. He didn't. Remember, I found out. I got a text alert on my phone that David Sampson, president of the Marlins, will not be retained by the team, by new owner Derek Jeter. That's how I found out. So I called him. And I asked him whether it was true. And he said, yes, as a matter of fact, it is true. I said, okay, thanks for the news. See you later.
Outstanding. Outstanding. David, great stuff. Appreciate the time. Check out the podcast, Nothing Personal with David Sampson, every day, wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, you're doing a lot with CBS Sports HQ, right?
Yes, it's fun. I get to be an MLB analyst on CBS Sports HQ. And I get to do a podcast about all sports, all entertainment, politics, anything I want to talk about, anything that's trending, try to explain to people really what's happening because I've been in the room where it happens for so long that I can sort of separate fact from fiction when it comes to stories that are being told by owners or players or anybody. And we've had a lot of fun. We've been doing it just about over a year and I love every day. I'm very lucky. Thank you, Derek.
Appreciate it, David. Thanks again, man.